This is mayor-to-be Gavin Buckley on the Maryland Crabs saying, this is the best solution to a hangover, listening to these guys talk. I feel better already.
Live from a grungy kitchen table located in Annapolis, Maryland's scenic and historic capital, it's the Maryland Crabs Podcast. With each episode, your hosts, Tim Hamilton, John Frenay, and the occasional guest will dive in and pick apart the stuff that really matters most to you. We're too lazy to actually solve any of these problems, but we can definitely stir the pot. From schools, politics, parking in the fire lane, to those horrible people who drive BMWs. And here with this week's episode, live from the kitchen table, Tim Hamilton and John Frenay.
And we're back here with the Maryland Crabs. We're coming at you from the Commons. It's a drinking episode. It's 7:30 on a Monday night, and we are here with a...
It'll be great if it's 7:30 in the morning.
7:30 a.m.
Which I've done.
Hey, we are here with a repeating guest, Alex Pline.
Who was our drinking buddy last time,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do I always end up with the drinking episodes?
Well, I think that's the only way we get you.
You came here with beer on your bike.
That's right. You bike.
That's right. I don't have to drive.
This could be around the block, and I would have still driven.
Is that illegal? Biking and drinking? Not recommended.
Yes, I think it is illegal. But you don't lose your license because you don't need a license to ride a bike. So
they just let the air out of your tires and say push it home.
Yeah. Well, you can get drunk and disorderly conduct or whatever.
I have.
Plenty of laws to take care of that.
Interesting. Well, last week's episode was great. We had Gavin Buckley from his bed.
Literally.
It was a good interview. It was a fun interview. Gavin was a real good sport. Still claiming that we almost screwed up the election for him, but almost.
I can only
count.
Imagine how tired those guys are after.
They were so exhausted. We went to that party the night. I wasn't planning to. My wife was there, so I went over to the party, and they're exuberant, but they looked exhausted.
I was watching it on Facebook Live, and that was enough.
You know, it's funny. I saw a Facebook post from Scott Travers, who's Gavin's campaign manager, from his girlfriend, and she's like, "Thank God this is over. Now Scott can wear a different shirt." Because everywhere you went, it didn't matter. I mean, when we very first saw him back in, when was that? Last year before he really officially declared. And Scott was there at the very first time, probably at the Ferris wheel one.
Right.
He had his Gavin for Mayor shirt on and whatnot. So it'll be interesting. He's down in Australia right now. He'll be back in a couple days.
Yeah, he called right afterwards to ask our permission. He goes, "I'm going to Australia. Okay, is that all right?" I'm like, "Yeah, it's fine. And just be back by Thursday."
I got the keys to City Hall. But
I heard they're going to have the inauguration. They're not going to have it at Maryland Hall. That's the rumor.
They're not?
That's the rumor. I didn't check it out.
Is that where it usually is?
Yeah. Huh. I can't imagine it wouldn't be.
It takes effort to find these things out, and I'm not going to make it. So I'm just going to call it a rumor and let everyone else do their own research.
I mean, that makes no sense because, the inauguration is on
December 4th.
It's on the election cycle calendar. Yeah. It's the first Monday after the next month after the election. But I'm surprised it won't be in Maryland Hall. I can't think of a different venue that would accommodate as many people will probably want to attend this.
You could do an outside thing, sort of like they did for Trump's inauguration. You know, do it on West Street.
Yeah.
Have people spilling over to the streets.
Could be, but December 4th is kind of dicey.
It's the day after my mom's birthday. I'm going to be a little tired.
And you don't know whether the parking garage will be open by that time or not when they're done with their renovations.
We're done with the elections, and now you have all the promises and all the rhetoric that kind of came out of that. And we talked about all of the debates and forums, and they all pretty much had the same thing. Because, there was dozens of them for mayor that they answered the same questions over and over. And the one that came up, let's say we have a crime. We had parking. We had quality of life. We had
development.
So, and that's why you're here, is because we're going to talk about development. Because, it's funny. You were very studious, and you sent us all these notes today going, here's what I'd like to talk about. I'm like, wow, at least someone prepared, because we're not going to do it.
And I did watch the video that you sent, and I saw Annapolis had a cameo in that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, after all the rank of the election cycle, I think it's time we can have a more nuanced discussion because, I think it started for me on John Assel's first flyer that came out.
With the giant cranes.
Yeah, with the giant cranes overlooking, superimposed over the view looking down Main Street with the headline, "How much development is enough?" And I was going to make a stink about that on Facebook because it really irked me. But I said, all right, I'm just going to let it lay. But it went from that to all the flyers we've talked about of who did or did not say what about some particular development. All the way down to, in my ward, this business about, is there going to be a cut through on Badger Road and the Navy housing? And it just got out of control. And I think it just perverted the discussion of a discussion that we need to have, because we're going to have development. I mean, that's just the way of the world. And so we have to figure out, well, what are we going to do? And we need to have a nuanced discussion about it.
Well, I think the interesting thing about that is it's sort of like you find that boogeyman, and you know, for the Republicans,
it's been used on both sides as a boogeyman.
No, but I mean, yeah. for the Republicans nationally, the boogeyman was crime. You know, that crime spiraling out of control, and it's not. It's just not. But people have that feeling that it is, and you can show them all the statistics that it's not happening. But it's a feeling. I think in this town, that is development. That you and I, and I'm pointing at John, we've had discussions about Forest Drive, and John's contention is that the traffic is not as bad as everyone makes it out to be.
I'd be in that.
I'm kind of between John and those other people, because I think it has potential to be hellacious. I think the lights suck.
But so does Route 50.
That's the point, is that you know, so is it the perception? Is that the boogeyman? They're like, it's a wedge issue almost. Is that the perception that development's out of control?
That's part of the discussion. The more nuanced the discussion is, you know, I think a lot of the planning dogma over the last 20, 30, 40 years basically equates one person with one car. And so if there are more people, there's going to be more cars.
Development I grew up that way. I think we all grew up that way.
But right. I mean, but that's our generation after World War II.
How many cars do you have personally?
None.
Me personally, none. No, I mean in my family.
Yeah.
we have two.
Two.
But one sits.
Okay.
Most of the time.
I mean, you've got four drivers.
Yeah.
And two cars. So it is. Yeah. It's not a one-on-one. I mean, it is in my family. My kids.
Well, I think. You know, but that's partially where we live in Annapolis, where you know there are other ways to get around.
Right. But they're not. I mean, if you live, they're not easy.
If you lived, you know, on the Broadneck Peninsula or in Severna Park or Montgomery County or wherever,
I'm from Montgomery County.
In a place. And we can talk about these in a little bit, about the reasons that you need to have a car to get around.
But in Montgomery County, I took the metro to high school and to school. And I didn't get my license until I was 17.
Montgomery County, that's sort of a blunt statement, because there are parts of Montgomery County that are not auto-centric. And there are parts like out in the Germantown area. I was out there for an event this past weekend. And, you know, you have to drive.
But I've heard those arguments before from various people who will say, hey, in Europe, they do this. They had the bike paths and stuff. But my argument is, like, we live in the suburbs here. We have, you know, Annapolis is between two metro areas. Our internal public transportation is mediocre. You know, I don't think they make it easy. It's, you know, it's not that consistent. But even if I want to get to D.C. or Baltimore, I can't do that.
Yeah,
Whereas if you're on the coasts, and even on the coast, you got to be in a major metropolitan area or the inner suburbs, like inside the Beltway or whatever the equivalent is in every city. But that's where it gets tricky, you know. So
let's back up a little bit to the big picture, because I think what part of the issue in the whole development discussion is we almost reflexively go down to the burr that's in our craw, and we talk about that because that's what's.
I think you just
mind.
Made that up.
Yeah, what's the right?
It's a burn to your saddle and burn you got saddle and stuck in your craw.
Thorn in my craw, whatever. Yeah, sorry for the mixed metaphor.
A burn in your craw. Would be really
I will never let a mixed metaphor go by. I'm going to pounce on it.
You know, I could think of a better bike metaphor, but
something about your spoke.
No, taintinitis is what you call that. Yeah, but we'll leave that one alone.
Okay.
So what I wanted to mention about is the development discussion has a lot of facets to it. So there's, you know, things like land use, you know, which is, are you going to have a commercial, residential, industrial? Then there's building form and development pattern. So is it going to be, you know, grid of streets like a city? Is it going to be curvilinear streets as in a suburb with hierarchical road networks?
What's density?
You can have density or no lack of density in any of these forms. You know, you could have, you know, a suburban curvilinear
loop-de-loops
with hierarchical road networks.
That's from Ani DeFranco.
With low density everywhere except for a very high density housing project or a housing development, you know, of townhouses or whatever. And we see those all over the county. And I mean, I would term that density without urbanism. So you get a lot of people in one place, but it's an island. So
it's a lax soul too. I mean, look at Columbia. Columbia.
Sure.
You couldn't pay me a living.
So keep that in mind. You know, I'll relay that to some stuff within the city. So you have those. Then you have architectural considerations, certainly.
But these are broad. But I mean, the architectural consideration wouldn't matter. It's weighted differently in downtown Annapolis than in Columbia.
So you know, you can think of those maybe as overlays, like the historic district overlay.
Right.
You know, and there are other overlays like in the use world, like maritime zoning, you know, you have to have a maritime use. And all those are very specific to the particular areas. And then you have transportation. Of course, that's what the development pattern's like and what the uses are directly affects the transportation. So if you have, take outer, the exurbs of Montgomery County, for example, if you have uses that are very far apart, you have to drive. Because nobody's going to want to take a bus because it's not very efficient. So if you have to go 4 miles to the shopping center to get a quart of milk, you have to drive. And, you know, it, so, and if work,
so your infrastructure needs to support that.
Everything's spread out. And then the last, so you're a good straight man here, John. So the last piece is...
Well, straight, I don't know.
Is the financial piece of this. So all of these choices that you might make in uses and development patterns... not so much architecture, but in transportation, all have a fiscal impact. So, you know, if you have very low density, you're going to have to run, you know, and you have places where you have sewer pipes and water pipes, because you have to run a lot of infrastructure.
For a small amount of people.
Right, for a small tax base. So, you know, you look at Annapolis, and even Annapolis, is, for as compact as we are, you know, even we're having trouble repaving streets that need to be repaved. So, take the famous Barbud Lane off Forest Drive with, you know, they come to city council meetings, you know, for a couple of years saying, you know, our street's a mess, repave the street. If the city had money, you know, if they were flush with money to repave the streets, they would have repaved it. But
it's not a priority. It's just a little tiny.
Right. But I mean, I think we have essentially more infrastructure than we can maintain.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you think about.
There's lots of case studies on this where if you take the classical cul-de-sac where maybe you have 10 houses, the street there is owned by the city, is maintained by the city, all the infrastructure is maintained by the city. That infrastructure is for the exclusive use of, say, those 10 houses.
Right.
And if it's a new development, developer pays, you know, hey, we get all this free infrastructure. That's great. So for 20 or 30 years, while it's working right, it's free money.
It's like buying someone a puppy.
You get that tax revenue. But are they, you know, are places like Annapolis taking that tax revenue, putting it in the bank, and waiting for the time that you have to rebuild that sewer pipe in 30 years? No. So, you know, that's going to be a problem. And then if you actually did the calculation of, say, what does it cost to repave the street? And then look at the tax revenue that you get. The tax revenue isn't even going to pay to repave that street every 30 years. And so that's just repaving. It's not accounting for the sewers and the water and any of that.
Well, you've seen responses to that in D.C. and other cities where you have the BIDs, the business improvement districts. Those are the groups of businesses that live with that... are established, let's say, like on Inner West Street. And you don't quite have that with what Gavin had established there, but it's kind of along that direction where they kind of tax themselves for the most part. And then if they need an improvement like that, they make that improvement because they can't count on the city to do it. I'm probably grossly oversimplifying it and maybe even getting wrong. Yeah. But again, research is...
So part of it is you have to think about development patterns that, you know, essentially maximize the use of public infrastructure. So in an article that I wrote, I think I sent to you guys about the Taco Bell on West Street
that
was put in. So if you look at whatever was put in there, the city has a certain amount of infrastructure they have to maintain. So, you know, whatever they have, 150 feet of frontage, there's stuff they have to maintain.
I think
that's
sidewalks and curbs and roads.
All that stuff. So regardless of what goes on there, the city has a liability. So the question is, what do you want to put on there? What kind of development do you want to put on there that's going to maximize the return on investment of that public infrastructure? Is it a place like, and the comparison I did is you look at Ram's Head, you look at what they pay in taxes, the valuation of the building and the land and what they pay in taxes, divide that by the square footage of the lot, you come up with a value per acre, essentially, of, you know, what the city is gaining in revenue per acre. Contrast that with the brand new Taco Bell, and it's about a 6-to-1 difference because, you know, part of the deal is most of the lot where the Taco Bell is a parking lot. Parking lots pay very little taxes.
Well, also, so, I think as you in a concentric circle going away from the city center out, which I think...
But I would say even the buildings, the old whiskey was there, I would term... So this concept we call financial productivity of, you know, essentially...
Yes, that's what we call it.
So
I'd never called it that.
I would say the whiskey was financially more productive than...
Just because it was a larger building?
Yeah, it was a bigger building that brought in more
taxes. Aren't you paying on that entire property?
Well, so this gets into sort of tax law where we pay
My specialty.
We pay for the inherent value. There's part of the tax is based on the inherent value of the land, and part's based on the improved value. Typically, we tax the improved value more. So if you have a lot And you can get revenue to make out of making a parking lot. You're going to leave it a parking lot because you get revenue, you pay very few taxes. There's no incentive to improving that. So, you know, if you flip-flop that around and you base the tax revenue on the inherent value of the land, so take a piece of land in Inner West Street that's a parking lot now. If you were taxed on the inherent value of that land because it's in a sweet spot in downtown and you're only making, you know, what, $200 a day on charging for parking, you'd be like, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to build a building there and get the highest, best use out of that land. But there's no incentive to do that because you essentially maximize your revenue, the revenue you get minus the taxes you pay, by having a parking lot. Is that the incentive we want to have in the city?
So what's the solution to that?
Well, what would you propose for the
top? Well, I mean, so you have to address that at the county level because our taxes work at the county level. And I think the county's going to run into the same problem. They need to start flip-flopping that.
What would you have proposed for the Taco Bell?
I don't know. I'm not a developer, but it has nothing to do with the program, and that's what I said in my article. I don't care what's in there. It's more about the form of the building. And I think as redevelopment happens out, you know, as we see in the Upper West Street study, as redevelopment happens there and that area gets more popular and the land becomes more valuable, there are going to be higher and better uses for that land than a drive-through restaurant. And it's not even so much that it's the drive-through restaurant, it's the form of that building that really got me. It's just not a good use of.
But now you're running into land use issues, or yeah, land use rights, I'm sorry. So, you know, if I own property use rights. So you're talking about development in so much as what should be permitted to be built there. And if I'm owning the property, I'm like, well, wait a minute. It doesn't matter to me because it's my property. The taxes are secondary.
What the zoning says you can do there—that's a governmental function to set that policy.
True.
So you think about how our planning and process works. So we do these. We have the comprehensive plan,
right?
And we have these sector studies.
It's on a shelf somewhere. Yeah.
Well, I mean, so that's what I want to get at is that we have the comprehensive plan. We have the sector studies, which are essentially like a framework.
You know what? Hold on.
But the key piece about those is they're advisory. There's nothing statutory in those. You have to get down to the nitty-gritty. If you ever comb through our zoning code,
oh, I have. Unicode. I do it all the time.
Right, so yeah, you and me both. That's where the rubber meets the road, because that's statutory. That's what, when a developer comes in, they have to look at those requirements, and that's what's going to determine what actually gets built. So we can have all this great stuff in these comprehensive plans that say, we want it to look like this, we want it to look like that, we want it to function this way. But if the code doesn't actually say, do it that way, you get something different.
Let's take a huge step backward, because we referred to the master plan in passing several times over the last 90 episodes.
The comprehensive plan.
The comprehensive. Yeah. Uh-huh. So let's talk about that for so people understand exactly what it was, because I think that's a wonkish thing. It was, I think, 2009 was.
Yeah, so municipalities have to do it every 10 years, and at five
years,
they
we're almost due for another one.
Yeah, they just last year.
By state law?
I think it's in the charter for the city.
Okay. Yeah.
So he just, was it last year or the year before we had a 5-year update that Sally and
I presented? It would have been 3 years ago. Because we're 2 years out from the next one.
Yeah, so it's coming up. So we have these plans that, you know, I think of them as big picture visions.
So the commission came in.
They generally get a consultant to do that. So planning and zoning. So this is Sally Nash's bailiwick as chief of comprehensive planning.
That's such a great word.
Chief of bailiwick.
Bailiwick.
Oh. So they typically hire a consultant to run both the comprehensive plan and then these area small plans. So at the county level, we have an analogy that's the general development plan and then small area plans at the county level. But in the city, we have the comprehensive plan and then sector studies. So we did one for West Annapolis.
Downtown. Forest Drive's working
Eastport,
on theirs right now.
Forest Drive. And so, that way you can specialize on the context of those areas. And they might have different recommendations because each neighborhood is a little bit different.
Right.
And they should be, because they all have their own personalities and different strengths, weaknesses.
How does a comprehensive plan get developed? Okay, you've got a consultant that comes in that facilitates this. I mean, what public...
Yeah, they have public meetings, and, you know, depending on the consultant that's hired, a lot of times you'll hear the word charrette, which is...
I love that word. We have that word, for the market house all the time.
Yeah, which is a word sort of in the new urbanism world.
It's French for meet a lot and don't do anything.
Which is charrette. The idea of getting people to give their input, really, in a sort of collaborative manner.
The very first time I heard it was with Ellen Moyer in the market house. We're going to have a charrette.
Yes.
And I'm like, the hell is this? I had to go to the dictionary. So,
but it's, you know, it is, you know, if you ask a consultant about that, they'll say there's something very special about the way people participate. And it's much more participatory than having a public meeting that you put up some boards, you ask for people's comment, and then you tell them to go away.
True, but focus groups are, they're kind of bullshit just because you will have a few vocal personalities in each focus group who will dominate the conversation. And you think that is representative of the public at large. And it's generally
and
not.
And charrettes are, I think, are only as good as the people that run them.
Yeah, even, you know, they have to be. Even then, I think
they have to be run well, and they have to get the right people.
If you listen to the people of Annapolis, they want fresh fruits and vegetables and meat and everything out of the market house, and that's bull. They don't.
Right.
They do not.
Anyway, so but yeah, back to the planning process. So if you read the comprehensive plans, it's fairly top level. It has, you know, goals and objectives, but it doesn't get down to the nitty gritty. And even in the sector studies, they have goals and objectives, and often some recommendations to change. You know, maybe change the uses in the zoning for the particular area, something like that, that comes out of those.
So we have a big study that comes out that was purchased from a consultancy. But they come in, they look at the cities in large, and they looked at sectors within the city to make recommendations.
Yeah, those are typically separate.
The separate ones?
Yeah, well, I mean, the comprehensive plan is a separate activity from the sector studies they've done.
So we have
different contractors.
So after they leave and we write them the check and they take off, we have the comprehensive plan that sits on a shelf somewhere in City Hall.
Well, so they actually have to get
a plan to move forward.
It has to get approved by City Council, and they either bless it or they don't bless it. And if they don't bless it, I don't know what they do. They go back and do it again? I'm not really sure.
They write the check and start it.
So what did our city, what did our comprehensive study say in 2009?
Boy, that's a whole podcast in and of itself. But
we
I think
we got beer. We got
but I think a lot of it talks about what the place should look like. You know, what's the vision of what the city should look like? What's
so essentially, the form of the buildings? They made a grocery list while hungry.
Right? I mean, visually, well, or that's kind operationally, of, that's
yeah,
all sorts of
how the city should function. But it's ultimately, it's just advisory. It's a framework to help guide the city policymakers. Okay, if we're going to change our zoning code, is it consistent with what's said in the comprehensive plan? But the plan
does
itself,
anyone ever do that?
You hear that in
no, I mean, seriously. I mean, do you talk about changing the zoning? For example, when they look to change the zoning at Compromise Street and the whole thing for the yacht club, did they say, well, let's go check the comprehensive plan and see
yeah,
what
we're... Yeah, that's part of the process.
Did they?
And I think...
Did they?
My opinion is that it's often lip service.
Okay.
But also because these plans are pretty high level, you sort of drive a truck through them. You know, it's very subjective. What's consistent to one person might not be consistent to another person.
Well, and also because it's advisory, you're not...
Exactly. I mean, the only thing that you have to do is check to make sure it's consistent, but that's pretty subjective.
Is there really a point to having one, in all honesty?
Yeah, I think there is.
I mean, have we been...
But I think... So
have
where
we been
I
good
think,
at following what we...
Where I think we have a disconnect is going from the top level of the comprehensive plan, the sector studies, to what are the actual regulations in the city code make developers, you know, how do they respond to that and what the built environment ends up being? I think there's a disconnect there.
Well,
and so part of the thing that I think there is, you know, we have, I don't know what the exact number is, but like
17.
32, oh, I don't know. I was just 32 zoning districts in a city of 8 square miles. So that's like C1, C2, neighborhood overlay.
All right.
Mixed use, professional.
Maritime and everything.
You know,
else.
I mean, there's a million. And it's almost down to the. And these things happen over time. Just sort of organically, you get another little. Somebody wants to change this, we change that. You're not saying those things, those ideas are bad, but you look later, and now you look at our code, and it's kind of a mess. So I think we need to take a big picture look at revamping the entire city code.
Well, and that was my point when we were talking about the elections, is because that's what every candidate said, especially Gavin said, I'm going to try and do the accent. We got to look at the code. You know, but everyone said that, and it got to be one of those things that it was almost not meaningless to me, but it just became one of those canned items. Going when they're asked, going, what do you think about development? Everyone would say, well, we have to look at the code and just say, but no one, including us, no one ever pressed them to say, what does that mean specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I think with respect to some of the developments, especially Eastport Landing, because there's been true questions about, you know, how do you actually calculate the density? So that shows a weakness. vagueness that there's ambiguity in the code.
Well, the city couldn't even agree with itself on that.
Right. So
I'd get these ranty texts from John going, have you seen this? I'm like, I'm not paying attention. I think
the kinds of comments that are made about revamping the zoning code are more along the lines of, like, let's just tighten up these problems that we have with the existing code, not taking a step back in looking at how does the code that we have determined what actually gets built.
I think you're exactly right that we're the conversation during the elections was about plugging holes in the existing codes, right, and the process.
Like what?
These density calculations.
Right. Okay. Like they're doing planning and stuff like that. That's the problem there.
Explain that a little bit, because you got really in the weeds on that one, because you were kind of following that really closely.
Not too much. I mean, there was just different ways to determine it. Right. I mean, there at one point they said that you take the size of the property, divide it by a number, and that's what you come up with your allowable unit. So it was 6.9 acres or whatever the hell it was, and then that's what it was. That's where they came up with 163 acres. Well, somebody else interprets it now, because it was never fully defined, and says, oh, no, it's the improved square footage. So now you're looking at the square footage. You're basically subtracting all the parking lot and landscaping, and now that's where you're coming down to the 63 units or whatever it is that it is. And that's where they're in the system.
I don't necessarily think that was a mistake per se. I think in these planned unit developments, the idea was to provide flexibility so that if there's a local context that makes you want to shift things one way or the other, you're not constrained by it says thou shalt do this. The idea was to provide some flexibility, but with that flexibility comes some ambiguity. And
well, that becomes a mess because also
problematic, for sure.
Let me just jump back to you. I mean, that's what the election, I think, was talking about. Yeah. Let's plug these holes. Let's make this less ambiguous. Right. Let's turn around and say, you know, this is how we do. This is how we get a building. This is how we get a business open in Annapolis without going through the bullshit that we currently do. That chases people away. And I mean, you've talked to dozens of people that have said, oh yeah, I was so psyched to go to Annapolis, but then, oh no, you know, I just have one meeting and I'm out. And you're talking about more of not necessarily sort of reinventing the vision of the zoning code of how.
There's a lot of different strategies you could take. And I'm certainly no expert, so I don't want to claim to be one. But what's sort of in vogue now that a lot of larger, both smaller and larger cities are doing, are looking at things, what they call form-based codes, which are not so much, you know, you calculate, you have this setback and you calculate floor to air ratios and all this kind of planning gobbledygook. But it basically more says, what do you want this place to look like? Because that's what I think viscerally, that's what people react to. They look at a development and they say, ugh, I don't like the way that looks. They don't say, well, the floor to area ratio is wrong to have five stories. And they don't get into that. They'd say, well,
I want to look at
a code that I can look at and interpret in a way that makes me understand what the end result's going to look like.
Have you ever seen the artist representation of what a project's going to look like afterwards when the developers come to the city? And it's always fountains in the center with like parks and people with dogs. And then at the end of it, it never looks like that. 1901 West Street looked incredibly different than it looks now, which is just a big box.
Right. So form-based codes basically give you a way to specify, you know, what the place should look like. Not so much these very details about box sizes and setbacks and all that kind of stuff. I think that would go a long way. Another thing that I would be a proponent of is much less restrictive uses. So West Annapolis, for example, what you can do along Annapolis Street, if you want to open a business along Annapolis Street, oftentimes you might want to do something that's not a permitted use. You know, it's not like you're putting a steel smelting factory in there. So as an example, we had to modify the zoning code to allow Pilates studios. So somebody wanted to open a Pilates studio.
Because that's a gym.
Yeah, right, or whatever. But the idea was that was not a permitted use. You think because that was not a permitted use, anybody cares whether there's a Pilates studio there? That's clearly a use that's not obnoxious, right? But the fact that they had to go through a four-month process to get that use change to open a building, it's ridiculous.
So there's one side of me, or there's a bunch of sides where you go, you look at, say, well, who would object to that? And you say, common sense, if I'm sitting in zoning, I'm like, yeah, of course. But someone in zoning who's doing a CYA is going, hey, wait a minute. I got to do this by the book. You know, I don't want someone to come to me in 2 months and when, if there's a problem. Yeah,
so what I would say is have, you still need some sort of uses because, you know, again, you don't want somebody to put a delivery warehouse in a residential neighborhood. Clearly, that's not a compatible use. But I think the categories of uses could be much more broad, which would allow much more easy reuse of the existing buildings as the economy changes, and it just makes it more flexible.
Right. Well, so, it makes sense. You turn around for a Pilates or something, gyms or athletic things not to exceed X square feet or something along those lines.
So, I tell you what, let's
get a refill.
I can't help notice when my beer is empty.
All right.
So why don't we take a break? We'll rehydrate, which is very important in this sort of situation. We'll come back and we'll solve all the problems at zoning.
Good deal.
Of all the ways our customers can describe us, nothing means more than being their favorite.
Zachary's is the gold standard in customer service.
This is the absolute best jewelry buying experience of my life.
The annual holiday party for their customers is beyond a memorable experience.
They have the most exquisite jewelry, and the store atmosphere, it's the best around.
They listen, and there's never any pressure to buy.
We've purchased fine jewelry from different big names in the Baltimore area, but we were treated like family at Zachary's.
You'll not find a nicer group of people. They have my business for life.
Best in Annapolis is simply not enough.
Zachary's has been a part of many of my life's best memories.
After it's all said and done, there's one jewelry store that's my absolute favorite.
Zachary's. Online at zacharysjewelers.com. More than a jewelry store, a jeweler.
When you're a community bank, you help your community however you can. Like being there for local business people. Backing them up when they start up. Advising them when they ask. Standing by them so they can grow. Helping local businesses is one of the most important things we do at Severn Bank. I'm Alan Hyatt, chairman of the bank, but I'm also a proud supporter of businesses in Anne Arundel County. You know, we never forget that here at the bank, we're a local business too. We face the same challenges and opportunities as any business. And we know how fortunate we are to have customers who stand beside us. That's why we stand beside you. If you have a business or you want to start a business, talk with us. Because we're banking on you. Severn Bank, here with you.
Online at SevernBank.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Severn Bank is a trade name used by Severn Savings Bank.
And we all have our beers. I've got a Stella, and John's got a Stella, and what do you got? You have
Flying Dog.
A Flying Dog. I'm a local beer
Alex
guy.
Is supporting local.
Yeah.
We're going to mention
what the name of it is.
It's a dog, doggy style. Nice.
Yeah, pale ale.
And then they've got Raging Bitch, and there's another one they've got. I can't remember their.
Probably my favorite is Loose Cannon because it's. But I like the name too, but that's about.
I can't do IPAs. Close. They're too bitter for me. I do Miller Lite.
It's kind of an acquired taste.
I do Miller Lite, Stella, and Guinness. Those are like my big.
I got turned on to some of the. I want to call fruity beers, but not the fruit infused beers, but the sours. Right, I guess is what they're called, which are kind of cool.
I hate fruit beer. I went out with Liz Murphy, that's Annapolis Pint. You got to listen to her podcast. And we went out, and she picked some really cool beers. My wife appreciated and everything, uh-huh. And they were fine, but at the end, I just want to go home and have Miller Lite. I am so trailer park.
She's probably like cringing now.
She is.
I'll tell you, one time we were at Bar Oak, and she recommended this Triple Degar. Therese and I were drinking it on the 4th of July, and it was something like three beers, and we were just all absolutely plastered. It was, we went back and looked, and it was like an 11 point something or other.
It's like a double IPA.
Yeah, the old Stein Inn out there. You have like one beer, and you are just flying. I'm like turning over the keys to one of my kids.
My favorite, just to give a plug to probably something nobody's ever heard before, but
I've heard of a lot of stuff, Alex.
A brewery in Milton, Massachusetts makes this IPA called, and just the name is awesome, it's called Boom Sauce. And it come in 4 packs of 16-ounce cans.
Boom Sauce.
And it's maybe the best IPA.
Did you guys grow up drinking Mickey's, or is that a regional thing?
The Mickey's Wide Mouth?
The Big Mouth, yeah. The grenades, remember you'd slice your finger open when you were opening the top of them? They turned them to like the turn. You never had those, John?
Uh-uh.
They were like these. They looked like hand grenades, and they had like these.
Right. It was almost like a barrel shape.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like a.
And
glass
they were
barrel.
Small. They were probably yeah. 10 ounces. Or something.
Probably for ease in throwing.
You would pull the top off. It was like a two-process thing where you'd pull the top and you have to spin it and tie it, and everyone it would just slice your finger. Yeah. Just huh. Everyone.
It was and then, just, of course, then, you know, being from Massachusetts, we had old froth and slosh.
Jesus.
I do know. I remember
hearing
that.
Yes, the
with the foam on the bottom.
What?
Yeah, that's. I don't know if you could still if they still make it anymore.
I want that just to
you
try.
You could get it
foam on the bottom.
You could get it in Kenmore Square in Boston.
So you don't have the accent. See, yeah. So John's a Philly guy. You're a Mass guy. I'm the only semi-local guy.
Well, I love the names of some of the beers that, you know, like I say, the craft beers that are out there. They're sort of reminiscent of like the hot sauces that you see at the
the Widowmaker
California Tortilla, and you know, well, you got the burn your ass, you know, whatever it may be. But it's kind of funny. But we were talking about a holy look, Holly, I guess.
That's Holly.
None of the W.
Holistic, you mean? Holistic?
Holistic? I don't know. We're looking at a big picture look at, you know, looking at development and looking at, as opposed to on a project basis, I guess.
You know, we were talking about this. I was talking with someone about this recently where they were complaining about work. And I said, the biggest problem, I think, with any job you ever have is differentiating between the work that you do and then the deep work. And no one ever gets the opportunity to do deep work. When I used to supervise people, I would try and allocate time like once a week where they could do deep work. But mostly it was task-oriented. And I think that municipalities and city governments, state government, all governments are the same way, is that there's no innovation because they're just trying to do what you need to get by. So when
right.
we talk and, about
you know,
redoing...
Typically staff's got a million projects.
Right.
They're trying to be as responsive as they can to projects.
Unless you have a commission, assigned a commission to rewrite the code, which is a daunting task. I mean, you and I were talking in the break about Miami, and you said if they can do it there, we can certainly do it here. But
Buffalo, New York did also.
But what's the impetus to cause a municipality to do that? At what point would the municipality just throw down?
Well, I think a municipality, often like a place like Buffalo, will look at what their built environment is and why it's not working, and because they have problems. You know, you see this in Rust Belt cities too.
Mainly that they're in Buffalo.
Well, I mean, economically, they're not doing well. So they say, well, what's preventing economic growth in the city? And so they look at all the regulations they have and say, well, this is clearly not working. Let's do something else. So in bad times, when often you don't have anything to lose, it's easier to do that. If you're in pretty good shape, and then, you know, I put Annapolis
play
on
it safe.
You can play it safe.
And, well, you and I were also talking in the break that so, what are the issues that are endemic? Like,
but I think we have those issues here. They're just a little bit below the surface.
Like what?
Well, the fact that we have a debt problem in the city. You know, I mean, we have
all cities do.
Right, but I mean, if you look at our debt, and that's something Ross Arnett's, you know, brought up over, and you know, this was something that was part of the election. You look at the debt we've assumed over the last 4 years, and it has gone up. Not a lot, but it has gone up. A lot of that is, you know, we have to be careful about the things that we have to finance, like the Hillman Garage. That's a transportation issue that plays into, okay, if we have ways to get around that are not so auto-centric, maybe it takes a little pressure off needing as much parking.
Right, so the zoning thing, so now we're getting to kind of kissing cousins. We get an overlap, so which is...
Well, it is. I mean, they are
no,
kissing
but,
cousins.
No, but what I'm saying is, or so if we're talking about like business administrations, which we've not had in a long time, I'm not picking on anyone. It's just because you have people who've not owned businesses who are running a government and they don't see the importance of businesses. I'm not faulting them. But I am saying that we've always contended that it doesn't matter if a business is successful or not, because your property taxes are going to be the same regardless. So what does it matter if you have a boarded up building or you have a thriving business? The city has never had a dog in the fight when it comes to promoting business interests because they don't care. And I don't mean that cynically, I just mean, why would they? Because they're not making more money.
Right.
So if you're talking about rewriting the zoning code, that's not going to do that. That's strictly,
that's not going to affect.
That's,
I mean, the fact
that's
that,
strictly on revenues because you're talking about the way that a property is taxed or the way that
right.
a building is built.
I don't think that has anything to do with a building owner on Main Street saying, "Well, I don't care whether the building's empty or not." There's really nothing the city government can do about that I mean, they could do something, but it would be very anti-competitive or
But it comes down to, let's say that if you look at Compromise Street, and the big problem with that was zoned for maritime. You had to have a maritime business in there, and I think the contention was, well, wait a minute, we are not a maritime city anymore. We are not. We are pleasure cruises and boating, but you don't have watermen here anymore. You have like what, one sailmaker, you know, in town, which is I think maybe out of the city.
Well, I mean, without you know, I know this is sort of sacrilege to a lot of people, but I think the maritime uses in Eastport and Back Bay, certainly there's a lot of maritime business there, and that is really important.
But it's zoned for that already.
That's not
but,
a city
no,
dock.
But the district down, the maritime, there are three maritime districts, but the one downtown, I think there's a valid argument to be made that that's a day that's not here anymore.
Yeah, so that's my point, is that if you rezone that and you fix the zoning, because you had someone there who bought the building and said, look, I want to make this into a booming center down here, and they felt that their hands were tied because they had to find a maritime industry, which they did. But at the same time, do you have to make them jump through hoops? So then it is incumbent upon the city government where you say, look, we're going to rezone this in a way to make it easier to develop, which is going to... Well, but then we're back to my original argument.
Well, so
it doesn't matter.
If you had something like a form-based code, what around City Dock, what you really care about is not necessarily what's the programming inside the building. You know, I know a lot of people don't like Chipotle, but I don't care. Whatever. Chipotle can be there.
I don't.
And then, you know, whatever. And then close up. Somebody else can go in there. So that's the programming. What I really care about is what's the form of the building. So take 110 Compromise Street. What people are really upset about, I think, is what does the building look like? Not what goes in it or what activities, what uses happen in it and what the mix of the retail is. What people really viscerally care about is what's it going to look like?
Do they care?
Yeah, I think people really care about it. That's why people didn't like the Ordan plan, because they thought...
You just hit on a hot button.
They didn't like it.
I mean, they're bitching about the one...
No, I mean, there's all other politics there, too.
But I've been drinking, so don't get me started.
I mean, they're bitching where the building where Harvey Blonder's built, the new Starbucks, where the old Zachary's...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because it's got the setback, and it's very modern looking, and it doesn't fit in with the thing. And I think there's something to be said. I think Eastport has a specific look. I think downtown Annapolis has a specific look. I think West Annapolis does to a degree.
Yeah.
Some of the outlying wards, not so much. I mean, it's a real sort of a mixed bag, which can be relaxed a little bit there. But I think I agree with you.
You know, something like the form-based code will help really get to what people are thinking they want it to look like.
So what happens? So we backwards engineer this from Crystal Spring or Providence Point. Where do you end up on that? Because that is now in limbo yet again. It has been for years. Right. So the big issue, I don't know if it's zoning, but the fact that it has to go through the city for approval, I don't know if zoning would affect that.
The problem that I have with most of the development along Forest Drive is that it's of a development pattern that's very inappropriate for cities. Take Crystal Spring, take the Giant or the Safeway, all of the new developments that have happened down Forest Drive, including the residential stuff, they're all islands in the sense that developer comes in, puts in their 100 houses or whatever they put in, or their store or their age facility or whatever the development is. You go in, it's this sort of landlocked little thing. And then there's the next one, and there's the next one. And the only way in and out is through the main drag, Forest Drive. So what's that mean? Nobody wants to connect things, because I get it. Nobody wants people going
traveling
between
their
thing and the next thing.
Well
that's,
also,
I mean, that's why people like cul-de-sacs, because, you know, they don't want through traffic. And that's why these ideas of cut-throughs are so controversial, like the one in West Annapolis that prompted the flyer, the WNAB.
The one also over on RST.
Right. Yeah, the one to South Cherry Grove.
Rocky
Gorge.
Rocky Gorge, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Rocky Gorge is the classic example of that, where this development pattern that was so prevalent in the 80s, this sort of suburban development pattern with the curvy streets and the cul-de-sacs, they put that in for Oxford Landing, but it just doesn't scale. It, you know, granted, we have a lot of geographical constraints on peninsulas, so there's only so much you can do. But take the Rocky Gorge area. Had that been a grid of streets like Eastport or West Annapolis, where you've got maybe two or three streets that are redundant, that all can distribute traffic, if you build out at the end of that, people aren't worried, like, all this traffic's going to go down my one street. And that's the problem with Rocket Gorge. That's what's caused all that problem. The people in Oxford Landing say, well, these 45 houses are all going to every morning go past my street.
But you know what? You do have that in Annapolis already. That's already exists. So if you look at between Forest Drive and Eastport, you've got Bay Ridge and Chesapeake. So those are the only going one way, going the other. That's the only way that you can get to downtown from that direction. You can only get from using West Street and then Bestgate, rather. But so Annapolis is kind of built that way. What's that?
You also got Spa and Chinkapound off.
But that dumps you. But that dumps you either onto Forest or Bay Ridge.
Yeah, and so the problem is there's really no easy answer here because.
And this is always my complaint with other people who said that.
But let's not make
we're colonial.
But let's not make right. But
we're a 350-year-old city.
I get that, and that's
no,
that's
you don't, Alex. I don't think you do.
That's an existing condition. But there are places like out on Forest Drive where it's a greenfield. So what do? We just keep doing the same old thing.
A what field?
A greenfield.
What's that?
Well, maybe it's brown or black or whatever from the blacktop that was there. You know, it's not.
Development?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so take the Lidl's.
Lidl
is going to go. Lidl. That whole area, Lidl. That part of Lidl, I don't remember how to pronounce
it. It's rhymes with needles.
But that whole part of Bay Ridge, you know, that could have been a neighborhood like West Annapolis or Eastport or something. But instead, what we do is we just continue to do the same old, same old.
Why do we do that?
Because that's what our code says. You look at our subdivision regulations, they say they discourage connecting streets. What's that, what it actually says, minor streets should not be connected.
Minor streets?
Yeah, so like your little residential street. What that says is build cul-de-sacs.
Right.
That's what that says. So that's why I say we have this disconnect between what the comprehensive plan says, you know, we want this, you know, this certain look, but then what actually gets built is not that because the regulations, what the developers have to follow. And, you know, developers, for the most part, I don't think are bad people. They're like anybody else.
Oh, yeah, they're bad. They're horrible.
Trying to make a living. I mean, not some of them, sure.
If someone touches Ebtide, I'm going to lose my shit.
Some, you know, everybody's trying to do the right thing.
No, they're not.
But if
the right thing for them, I mean, there's a very prominent developer. He's a very nice guy and everything, but he would pave over the city if he could. And I am one of those guys. Like I believe in property rights.
But we let that happen because of the way our rules are written.
How many CVSs do we need? And there's someone who looks at me and go, but it's their property. And I get that. But just there's a part like I grew up in Montgomery County, as John knows, and I just watched my neighborhood disappear. Like if I go back to visit my mom right now, there's nothing I recognize from when I grew up. So that's a nostalgic, selfish thing that I don't want things to change. And I think most people are like me. So when you talk development, that means change.
Yeah.
And it doesn't generally mean for the better. You know, it just, because it changes things that are endearing to you.
Right. Another facet.
And people romanticize
to the whole thing.
Mexican Cafe's food was horrible. So it's,
you know, as this area becomes more interesting to people who want to move here, if we say, okay, no more development, we don't want the character of the city to change, we're not going to build anything else, we're just going to keep it like it is.
It's like Ward 1, yeah.
What's going to happen is that's going to insanely raise land values.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're already seeing that because supply is constrained. So the value goes up. And what ends up happening is you price people out of the ability to live in the city.
All right, so we got 10 minutes left, so okay. I want you to revise the zoning code now. Tell me what if you're in charge.
It's not necessarily the zoning code either.
A couple of things that I've said. I think going to a more form-based, loosening up on the uses.
Like you got to break those down. Like form-based means what?
Meaning have the rules based on what things are going to look like and how they're going to function. You know, how does a building address the street?
But doesn't that open it up to interpretation?
No, I think from the form-based codes that I've looked at, they can be very tight, but they result in a very specific look of how things.
And you said the form-based codes that you've looked at, what cities have...
So if people are looking to get a flavor for that, I mean, first thing, you can go to Wikipedia and look at the article on form-based codes. It's a good...
Oh, I will.
Okay.
But there's also a site, and I have nothing, the disclaimer, I have nothing to do with these people. I've just read their stuff. There's an organization called Placemakers, and it's a consulting business.
Placemakers?
Placemakers. So placemakers.com. And they have examples from a variety of different cities that they've done form-based codes for of different sizes. So you can go and they have case studies to give you a sense of what they've done. So those are the kinds of things you can look at.
Do you know about rewriting the code? Is that something that is done, I'll show my ignorance here, is that something done by the law office? Or is that something that the city could hire placemakers? Yeah,
planning and zoning, that would be an activity that planning and zoning would undertake.
Could they hire placemakers to come evaluate their code and rewrite it into a form
base? I mean, that's the way this is always done. We don't have this, we have a staff of, 10 people in planning and zoning. They can't do this on their own, plus do their day jobs. Right. So typically typically you hire a consultant that has domain expertise here. So you have, the city would make a political decision. The city government would make a political decision. We want to do something with our zoning code. We have this idea of the way we want to go based on maybe our comprehensive plan. So they go out and look for the right consultant. So clearly you're not going to go hire a consultant that, has planning dogma from 1980. You're going to hire somebody with expertise.
But it's not just a consultant.
Expertise.
It's someone who's coming in and is going to leave you with a package that you can you can tweak on your own. At least that's a starting point, right?
Yep. And, that might take 2 or 3 years. It's not going to be an easy process.
Oh, sure.
But can be done.
Interesting. Because, that's certainly something that I know that Gavin Buckley was, advocating. I mean, everybody really was. I mean, Gavin and his take an abandoned store on Main Street and put a clock in.
But Alex is right. I mean, I think if you're looking at planning and zoning in the abstract where people says, we need to fix it, but I don't think, I've never heard of any specifics as to what exactly needs to be fixed. And I think if you press a lot of people.
They're just going to do more little tweaks that if you look at all the tweaks we've done over the years, that's gotten us into this aggregate mess. So when you're in a hole, what's the first thing you do?
I start digging.
You continue digging? You start digging.
Yeah, but that's my personality.
Yeah.
You stop digging, right?
No, yeah,
go
yeah.
Go do something different.
Yeah, you don't know me that well, do you?
I mean, so that's my suggestion. Not focus so much on uses, because that constrains what you can do in that building, and that makes it a little bit more fragile in terms of accommodating changes in the economy.
It makes a lot of sense. Do you think the city under a new mayor has the political will, what's your thought on that? Do they have the political will to do that, to undertake that?
I think we have a better chance now
than we did before.
The referendum, I think, in the city election was based on whether you like the status quo or whether you want change.
Sure.
And I think the voters spoke.
I think it was a resounding message that was sent out there, for sure. Where do you see the fire hoses? And that just a term is like, what's going to stop the political will? Where is the fire hose? Is Ward 1 going to object to this? Is this going to be a council saying, no, we don't need to do this? Is this because the council, we've got a lot of old, we've got some fresh faces, but we still have, some old stalwart thinking that is.
Yeah, I think it would take some real political maneuvering to get everybody moving in that direction.
But who would that behoove? Like, what group would have to come forward? Like, almost like if there's a real version of Steve Annapolis that wasn't.
Well, if Ward 1 wants it done, it'll.
Yeah, well, sure.
I think the city council will have to all get in that direction, and clearly they'd have to solicit input from their constituents. And if their constituents say, whoa, no, that's just too much change, then clearly they're not going to be interested in pursuing that.
Again, with my ignorance, could a code be changed per ward?
That's so ignorant, John.
Like, word to
word? Why not? I mean, we do have these overlays. Especially in Eastport, has an overlay that sort of helps maintain the character.
Right.
So I think it could be done. And that's what the sector studies are for. To bring the individual flavor to the neighborhood, so you're not imposing necessarily the same set of rules on every.
What about your bike paths, Alex?
Of course we need more ways to get around.
You know what?
More ways to get around on a bike that are safe.
I will agree with you on that, because my kids were stuck out on a peninsula, and for them to it's 2 miles for them to get to civilization, and I'd like them to do
and
it.
And a kid can ride a bike 2 miles without it.
Yeah. But every time someone says we need more bike paths, logistically, we have one bike path in town. Well, we have more, but we have that one that goes from in front of Safeway that goes nowhere. The bike path to nowhere.
But
Interesting
you bring that
it's
up.
Fascinating.
There is There is no reason that same multi-use trail, because it's 10 feet of blacktop.
Long.
Right.
10 feet wide.
Oh.
There's no reason that couldn't go all the way to Quiet Waters.
I'd love to see
there's
that.
There's no reason.
Well, you also
be.
Look at what
there's. I mean, you're gonna have to.
That way, they wouldn't
right
have to
away,
blow but, through stop signs.
No, but you're not
and
gonna have to. You're not gonna have
and...
to knock anybody's house down to do it, and you're not gonna have to take any way any travel lanes. You could do it.
I was so furious at a biker the other day because they blew through a red light in right in front of me, and I was gonna honk, and I thought Alex would yell at me if I did this. I actually thought that. I thought he'd be so mad at me.
Well, you know, you look what they're doing at the Severn River Bridge. I mean, they've taken what is it? Four lanes, and they're making the six are making eight, whatever.
They're making
it is.
Four eastbound
lanes
out of three.
I mean, they're just shaving the lanes a little bit. And I mean, to be honest with you, on Forest Drive, you could probably do that from Chinkapin all the way down.
No, not that one spot where it kind of curves.
Right there where Hilltop comes.
Yeah,
in.
Yeah, that's a tricky one.
Well, then you could pop up there and use that macadam thing. But I mean, I would think that we don't have any roads. I don't believe that exceed 40 miles an hour in the speed limit within the city.
Well,
narrowing
streets in a city.
I mean,
Tommy. I mean, notice I use the term street, not road. So,
I did notice that.
Have you seen this concept of a strode, which is a street road hybrid? That's any place that has a 35 to 50 mile an hour speed limit, you can consider a strode. Typically 4 to 6 or 8 lanes wide. Route 2 in Parole is that. If you've ever gone from Edgewater to, up to Route 50 on Route 2,
right?
What do you think especially when there's any traffic, what do you think your average throughput, if your average speed's going to be? It's probably going to be...
Probably 40 mile an hour.
No, it's
going to be like... On a Saturday afternoon?
No.
You're lucky if you average 20 child. Miles an hour
yeah.
the whole way.
Okay.
But what ends up happening is you go from stoplight to stoplight from 0 to 45 to 0.
Yeah.
0 to 40. And that's horrible. I mean, have you ever tried to cross Route 2 as a pedestrian to go over to town center?
I don't walk anywhere.
You should try it sometime. It's
no,
sobering.
Yeah. My legs get tired.
Really unpleasant.
Well, I think, when I lived in Albuquerque, it was all grid. It was all east, west, north, south.
Right.
So when you flew in at night, it was like really cool. And then it would just end at the desert. But all the lights had the signs on them saying lights are timed for 40. And then I always thought, well, they're also timed for 80.
If you get hit by a car at 40 miles an hour, you're going to die.
Well, not I'm very strong, Alex. Yeah. Well, all right. So we solved all the problems tonight, I think.
Well, so one last development that I think is worth talking about in terms of this island idea is, the Annapolis Towns at Neal Farm development. So it's off Old Solomon's Island Road, tucked off in that corner of the city, annexed that land.
Yeah, yes.
And so they're going to put in... This came up because I saw the advertisement in the Capitol.
That's sort of behind like Sin Fronteras.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh, that was a huge. That was a traditionally black neighborhood.
Yeah.
That was annexed about 6 years ago, so you knew they were going to develop. Oh, I've seen they've started working on that.
Right.
They were very upset with Classy about that.
You can see the ads. You can see the ads in the Capitol because they're selling them now.
Right. Which is sad because that was like a throwback neighborhood. That's the part of me that makes me sad. But no one asked me.
I mean, the world goes on. That's not something that we can deal with.
Not with that attitude.
But the problem that I have with the way that's been done is that townhouse development doesn't integrate with the rest of the community. And it was by design.
You go in there, there's one way in, one way out.
And the city didn't push it. But what's going to happen eventually is the next couple of plots are going to get sold, and they're going to put in probably another new place. And then all these places are going to be unconnected. So one of the things that I think the city should do is they should force these connections. So thinking about the NAV thing, and I know both of my, the Fred Payone and Kurt Riegel both were against connecting.
Right.
And my comment was, why don't you connect it from both places? That way you've got the ability to get through in case you ever need to reroute traffic. If you're worried about through traffic... Put in big speed bumps. Put in traffic furniture. Put in all the stuff that if you drive faster...
The traffic calming that you need to put in.
If you drive faster than 10 miles an hour, you're going to hit something. But connect them. Because that way, if you're riding a bike, as an example, you don't have to go a mile out of your way onto West Street.
Well, if you even
you could ride through there.
Victor Parkway over off Bay Ridge.
Right.
They have big gates put across the road so you can't go through for that reason.
Right.
Yeah, I never thought about that. We are very isolationist when it comes to our neighborhoods in this town. I mean, more so than anywhere else I've been.
I get it. Everybody wants to live on a cul-de-sac, and that's in your own personal...
And, well, we're also not saying the obvious, which is the public housing issue, you know, and we're saying that, yeah, that, there's a big part of that where, you know...
Yeah, but no, I don't... That's a BS argument.
Don't insult me on my own podcast.
You don't think Pizzuto wants to move into Admiral Heights, come through Admiral Heights as opposed to...
But the public housing thing, people say, well, I don't want to have access to my neighborhood because somebody might walk up the road from the public house. That's BS.
They're going to walk up anyway.
Exactly. So the fence at Victor Parkway, it's across the road, and the gate was actually closed for a long time. Josh Cohen got it opened. And because they stood out there at night, and there were people crawling over the fence. So I said, well, just open the stupid gate. So now the gate's open.
Right.
So people are going to walk, just because you don't have a connection, unless you put up a 20-foot high fence.
Build a wall.
People are, you know, you're not going to stop people from going through there. So that's, while that might be a problem, nobody wants, you know, somebody that's going to do harm in their neighborhood.
Well, I don't know, but a couple of my neighbors closing are ticking me off.
Closing a road off is not going to solve that problem. That's just, I don't know.
If somebody wants to do bad, they're going to do bad.
Exactly. We have people breaking into cars in West Annapolis. I mean,
well, you talk about the connecting the roads and keeping the bikes off of West Street as well. And you also, and I'm just thinking, because I live down on Forest Drive, I drive it all the time, that if you had those connector roads between the neighborhoods that sit behind there as opposed to Forest Drive,
right.
you're going to have the people be able to go through it. But I don't think you're going to necessarily, I mean, you wouldn't see all the traffic of Forest Drive come through that neighborhood.
Right.
Which is what I think a lot of people are sitting there saying, oh, I don't want all that damn Forest Drive traffic coming through my neighborhood. Well, no, you're not. I mean, if you're going to your house down at the end of Forest Drive, you're going to stay on Forest Drive. You're not going to cut down Bywater to go left on whatever the hell road they call it, Skipper's Lane.
But so not everybody has to ride a bike. But if you're going to drive the two or three blocks from your house to the Giant, if there were a side street, you just take the side street because it's going to take you, you know, whatever, a minute longer. Mm-hmm. But because there's no connections, what it forces you to do is you have to come out on the Forest Drive. So that's the thing with these hierarchical road networks is they funnel everybody out onto the main road, and then it's a mess. So the traffic that's just local or churn or whatever has other ways to do it. It provides some redundancy.
You know what kind of traffic I do like? I like traffic on our Facebook page. We have a Facebook page and we have a group. So if you want to find us on Facebook, that's where you go. We also like traffic on Twitter. So we are
at
MD Krabs Podcast.
It's a little more subtle than saying shut up.
At Ion Annapolis, at Tim Hamilton 47. Where can they find you?
I'm happy to say we didn't devolve into parking. And I can say that now because we're at the end, so we're not going to talk.
That's right. Hey, and if the internet gods are smiling down upon us, next week our guest will be former gubernatorial candidate Heather Mazur. And she has launched a new thing, a new podcast, so you ought to listen to it, actually called Soul Force Politics.
She had, what's her name on it? She had, what was her first guest? The singer.
Melissa Etheridge.
Melissa Etheridge, thank you. It took you 20 minutes to, you know what, I'm not going to even edit that pause out, and normally I would. I'm going to let that pause sit.
Okay.
Because you're off tonight.
They're BFFs.
Is she coming to play here?
I don't know, but she appeared on the first podcast.
Heather Mazur and Melissa Etheridge are good friends, and she allowed her to use her song for her podcast.
What was her podcast? Her podcast is
Soul Force Politics.
Soul Force Politics.
You can go look up Ms. Maryland, MZ Maryland.
Yeah, so go subscribe to that, and subscribe to ours at Apple Podcasts and Google Play. And John has his Ion Annapolis podcast, which is excellent, by the way.
Well, I'll make sure when this comes out, I'll go give you a 5-star review.
And give us 5 stars, Alex. And
give us 6-star, because Alex is and back a review. For a second time.
But we have other ones. We have the Annapolis podcast, of course, with Scott McMullen, and we've got
Scotty Mack.
So, and of course, the Annapolis Pint, and then More Power to You with Josh Cohen. Speaking of Josh, those are all great podcasts. So, of course, subscribe to them and give them some reviews and some stars because they could use it too. So, Alex, this is awesome.
All right. Well, thank you for having me again.
I can never have you during the day because you to me, it's like a Pavlovian response that you are a drinking podcast from now on.
All right.
So,
I'm always
which means
to
that
comply.
If we meet at 8 a.m., we got to drink. We'll take a nap around noon. So, Alex, hey, thanks again. And be careful biking home.
I will.
All right. Stop at the lights.
Thanks.
I always do.
This has been the Maryland Krabs Podcast with Tim Hamilton and John Frenay. Sure to follow them in all the regular places, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and online at themarylandkrabs.com. Take a moment to rate us on iTunes. Now, get the hell out of my kitchen. Seriously, go!
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.